Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is M.E. Girard, author of Girl Man's Up, a finalist for the William C. Morris Award. She joined me to talk about the necessary research involved in the agent search, the nature of self-editing, and the different stages of the authorial journey. One of the first questions that I like to ask all of my guests is about how they got their agent and the process to getting their first book deal, because I think there's a lot of frustration out there for aspiring writers about process to go from being in the query trenches or even just executing your first book before you get an agent or a book deal. So I think it's really important to talk to published writers about how it happened for them, because I know that's something I always wanted to know when I was aspiring, how the people that have had success managed to find that. So tell us a little bit about that.
It would be important for the person to know. For me, I was thinking when I started writing that I wanted to write a book and I wanted it to be on shelves in as many bookstores as possible. I wanted it to be accessible in the US and Canada. So being in Canada, this is something I had to think about because publishing can be a little bit different here. For me, I was like, I want to go big. That's how I felt about this vision I had. So I did my research, like, okay, what do I need? I need an agent. How does that work? There's a lot of research that goes on for this whole process. And I think that's an issue with a lot of people because they think that you need to just put a query letter together and send it to agents. But there's all these little guidelines and rules and tips that are out there that you should be aware of to make the process more successful. And it could be overwhelming. I went into this like I attack any work project. I did my research. I think it paid off in the sense that I was already aware that, you know what, your query letter is going to be a pain to write. It may not be successful. It may suck. You may have sent it to 65 agents and then you're like, oh, maybe it wasn't so good. Maybe I should have done it different. When you're new and you're going to aim for publication, there's so much information out there. There's so many books. Just do your research. See, I did so much research on getting an agent, and then I got my agent pretty quickly after a few queries. So I'm like, what do I do with all this freaking information I've amassed now? So I'm like, I'm going to put together a little course, and at least I can share it with other people. So there are people, they will have done the research for you and they will give you a nice little strategy. So go looking for that.
Is your course online or do you do it in person?
I've done it about 4 or 5 times. I do it in person. It's about an hour. I get some pretty good feedback from it. I revise it all the time to include things like Twitter pitches, and I'm starting to think maybe I should do like a little webinar thing. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, you should definitely consider it. It's interesting too. You said things change. I did a interview with my critique partner, who is R.C. Lewis. We met on a writer's forum when both of us were unpublished, and I wanted to have her on the show. One of the things that became obvious as she and I were speaking to each other was that most of the things that we were mentioning in our journey in 2008, 2009 are defunct now. They're gone. So we were talking about things like Authonomy, which was a program through HarperCollins, kind of like an early version of Wattpad, where readers would upvote stories and they would make it to an editor's desk. And that doesn't exist anymore. There were also a couple of blogs that we referenced that are no longer live, and they were imperative to us when we were in the query trenches, and they don't really exist anymore. So it's interesting the way things change.
Mm-hmm. I already knew too that it can take forever for agents to read your query letters. I went into this thinking it was going to take forever, and I think a lot of people get very discouraged because I do teach a little course or education session on agent queries. I know that a lot of people's faces would be like, that's how long it takes. So I think that that's something any aspiring writer has to be aware of, because it depends on the route you're going to take. There's a lot of people that would take my course that would think, that's not what I want to do at all. I want to pitch right to a small press, or I want to publish on Amazon, or I just don't want to take that long. And I think that's totally cool. Be aware of what you're trying to do before you get into it, because there's a lot of people that are suddenly realizing that they should have put some more thought into it beforehand. I don't know how your process worked, but that's what I'm finding, is I found that the research that I did was so helpful because I didn't waste any time.
I absolutely say over and over again on the blog and on the podcast with all my guests how important the research is, because as far as my querying journey and my process, it took me 10 years to get an agent. And that's my own fault because I didn't want to do that research. I wanted to write a query and get a book published and be famous.
Okay.
That was my goal, right? Which is just ridiculous. It doesn't happen that way. I was 20. I was kind of idealistic, but that's okay, because when I was 20, my writing really wasn't that good. It took me 10 more years to be able to write a book that deserved to be published. I think you make a good point too about knowing whether you want to go the traditional publishing route, be in the big box stores, which is a great buzz. It's a rush, but it's also, it has its own pitfalls and pros and cons. If you just want a published book, if you just want a physical object to hold in your hand or a file that has your name on it of something you created, go the self-publishing route. There's no reason why you shouldn't, but you have to be aware of the pros and cons of all the routes. And that's a lot of research. Yep. And knowing what your goals are is the first question to ask yourself.
Yeah. The other thing too, is I found once you do your agent query research, if you're going to go down that road, it kind of gets exciting, right? Because you're like, okay, I'm going to start sending this out. And you kind of forget, or you maybe aren't giving enough thought to the fact that, okay, does an agent want to read this? Because my whole thing was, I had a lot of people were really, you know, supportive and nice, and they're saying, oh, you actually wrote a whole novel, you should totally send it out. And in my head, I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure it's going to be crap. Is it even ready to send out? One major point that I remember reading was, is it so good to you that you figure you can't do anything else with it? Then that could be a good time to ask someone else to read it. It took me quite a few revisions. And then I felt like, you know what? I've read this a few times. Time has passed. I'm ready. So that, I think, is another time-consuming thing. I did take quite a bit of time to rewrite. I had a really hard time doing that objective read of my own work, which obviously is just a problem. Most of the time, I think when you're new, I find you don't really have experienced beta readers. I went the way of, I'm going to read books on how to revise critically. I'll do what they suggest and I'll do my own edits myself. So I did that. I took the time to do that as well. It wasn't a lot of time, but it was enough that I felt I had something pretty good.
Critique partners are absolutely critical to me in my process, but it is possible to revise critically your own work if you've trained yourself to do it. You also said something that I think is important. You said enough time had passed. I think you do have to let that time pass before you pick it back up and look at it again. It depends on your schedule. If it's possible, I will let as much as 3 to 6 months pass before I pick up my work and I look at it again critically. And I compare that to an infant, because parents, when they have an infant, are protective of it, conscious of its every breath, its every movement. And then by the time you have a toddler, you're like, tie your own shoe, feed yourself. Get trust. That's how I look at a brand new manuscript. It's your baby. You can't look at it critically. You're not capable. So you have to let some time pass. Then you're able to come look at it again and be critical of it.
A lot of these advice books will tell you literally put it in a drawer and not look at it for so many months or so many weeks. I can't do that. I just created this. I want to work on it. I want to actively be doing something to make it better. But then I found what was really helpful to me, if I worked on something else, if I got my head out of that manuscript and I was so into something else I was working on, sometimes within 2 weeks of being in this other manuscript, I could pick up my old one. Suddenly, I don't remember what I wrote because I'm so into the other one. And then I'm reading objectively. So once you've got your head out of it, and you can do that by putting it away physically for a long time, but I think also just getting to work on something else, new characters, creating something else, then it gives you perspective. Suddenly you're asking yourself questions. That's when my perspectives come back. I'm ready now to dive back in, and maybe that's 2 weeks.
You've been extracted from that world. You created it, and so you instinctively understand things about it that aren't necessarily on the page. They're not necessarily in the text. So if you leave it and come back and have immersed yourself elsewhere, you will see those things that your brain was auto-filling. Yeah. That wasn't necessarily there for the reader. I think that's always important.
If an agent does respond to your query, and then they request your manuscript, and they're telling you, I love the story, I'd love to represent you, which is like so damn exciting. And then a lot of agents are very editorial now. So then you go into like, I really love this, but. So that's another thing that can be crushing. So then my agent's editorial letter came through, and then went through quite a few revisions after that. And then if you're lucky enough to get a publisher, an editor, then you've got that. It's this constant, yes, this is so great, it's ready, only to be like, no, it's good, but it's not ready. And then, yes, I got it ready this time. Now what? No, you're ready in stages. In my journey, anyway, that's what I learned. I feel like the book is published now, but there are revisions I think I could still be doing if it was possible, but I think it's over now.
There's a constant cycle of being built up and then torn down, and it's actually incredibly conducive creatively. Most authors that I know, and I include myself in this, do not read the finished copies of their books because you do want to make changes. You do want to continue editing, and you cannot. It's finished product. There's one author that I know in particular who, when he is reading aloud at an event, he edits as he's reading. He'll be scanning forward and will make cuts and make edits and take out an echo here or there. And I think that's so funny because it's like you're constantly improving, even on the fly, even in the moment, you see something you think could be better in your finished product.
And I haven't read my entire hardcover of Girl Man's Up from cover to cover yet, but my girlfriend has read it probably 20 times already. So she'll say things, or readers will say when this happens, and I'm like, did that happen in my book? Because I have literally 12 versions of Girl Man's Up in my head.
I wrote A Madness So Discreet, the vast majority of that book, in 3 weeks. And I honestly don't know what happens in it. It just came out. I was volunteering in a library recently, and I was processing books, and A Madness So Discreet had come across my desk, and I picked it up, and I was paging through it. Yeah, I don't remember writing any of this. But it was also kind of cool because I was like, well, that's pretty good. It is an interesting self-exploration when you do read your final product, because as you say, most often you do have various revisions and additions in your mind that are still working, that are still evolving. And then you read that cemented final product that people are consuming. And sometimes I'll even get questions like, why did this happen in this book? I have no idea.
Let me spin up a really eloquent response here.
Right. But it's like, I don't remember that scene. Yeah. I'll have to take a moment where I'm trying to recall exactly what they're talking about. So in the more distance that you get, the more often that'll happen. I wrote Not a Drop to Drink in 2010. So I will get questions about it now, 7 years later, which is great. I love it that my first book is still resonating with people. And probably the one that I get the most questions about is Not a Drop to Drink. And I will be at an event and people will ask me questions about it, and I have to stop and think sometimes about what happened in that book.
Wow. I'm looking forward to that. I've got one book to keep track of. People will say, it's like when this happened and then this happened, it's like that ties this in with that. And like, wow. And I'm like, wow, I don't know if that was intentional, if it just worked out. There were so many revisions and different people's inputs and really expert input that led me to turn this into what it is now. I can't even imagine how like my agent feels, because she had so much input in the beginning versions and then did her job and then got an editor.
They see that evolution from the draft that you gave them to the one that they worked with you on to what the final product is. My agent isn't terribly editorial. She was with my first two books. She knows that when I give her a first draft, that while we're calling it a first draft, it has been through me 3 or 4 times. It has been through 3 or 4 published professional authors who have each of them their own strength. Adrienne isn't necessarily editorial with me now, but she was in the beginning.
I think that that's an interesting point right there, because your original question was about the journey to publication, which feels like, so you start out and then you've made it. But I'm realizing now I'm on to a different journey. So I think a lot of new writers are obviously interested in the, okay, I want to write, to, okay, my book is out. And that's such an important, incredible journey. It's got its tried and true methods for traditional publishing. All of us are able to give some insight now because we've been through it. But I think that the advice for what happens now, it's not really out there. Now it's a whole new journey. So yeah, I can talk about my journey up until now, but now it's a new one.
Publication isn't necessarily an end goal, it's a milestone. Novelist,
including the false romanticism of the tortured artist.
Girl Man's Up is your first book, and it has been very, very successful. You were a finalist for the William C. Morris Award, which is the award for the best debut work in your publishing year. You were reviewed by the New York Times Review of Books, which does not necessarily happen to everyone. We were actually reviewed in the same article, and that was my fourth book, and the first time I had been reviewed by the New York Times. So you received a lot of critical praise from many different corners, but at the same time, you are working full time. Before I started recording here, we were talking about how you spend most of your day cleaning up shit. So I would like to talk to you about how you have had success with your first book, but has it impacted your day-to-day life?
Oh, that's so funny. I think it's now been a few times that I'm asked about how this book thing has impacted my day-to-day. And my answer is always, well, I'm still cleaning up poo. I now have three chihuahuas and they are paper trained. They're trained to go in the general area of where the papers are. I say that because life is pretty much the same. I didn't really have many expectations, to be honest. I just was thinking, I want this book out there. It's almost like this writing thing, a lot of it happens outside of you. You're still at home, you're still doing your thing, and then you get some emails with some exciting news, and then you answer the emails, and then you're back to doing your regular thing. Then you go to work. I work full time as a nurse, come home, I watch Netflix, and then, oh, this exciting thing is happening, whether it's the editor is saying that considering for an award, you've been reviewed here, can you come to this trip? And it's like, yes, that's so exciting. And then thought of the email, then back to regular life. It has impacted my life in the sense that many times a day I can just stop what I'm doing and be like, oh my God, I published a book. I'm a freaking author. And moving on. It depends where everybody is in their journey, right? How many books they have. And if they're able to write full time, which I'm sure that would be lovely. I don't know if many of us will ever get there, which is fine if I've got my full time job there to carry me through life. Because of that, I think I spent a lot of my day not being an author. I'm just all these other things. My day to day, it's mostly these little bits of excitement and then go back to the regular thing. So I don't know. I don't know what it's like for you.
Oddly similar with the parallels. I got this was back in 2010, but I got the email from my agent saying that HarperCollins had offered for Not a Drop to Drink. The next morning I woke up and I was getting ready to go to work. I was working full time and I woke up and I was lying in bed and I was thinking, you're a published author, Mindy. This was your life goal. You achieved your life goal yesterday. Getting myself geared up to get out of bed, right? And I fling my covers back and I throw my legs over the side of the bed and I slide down into a pile of cold dog shit. Like, right up in between the toes, you know, all that. Okay, so my life didn't change. It was a wonderful wake-up call because, you know, your dog will still poop on the floor. People always talk about the call. It was actually an email. I lived by myself at that time, and I got this email. I was so excited. I called my mom, and she was in a knitting class, and she didn't answer. And I called my dad, and he's a farmer. He was in the tractor. He didn't hear his phone. I called my sister. She had a parent-teacher conference. I called my boyfriend and he was at work, and I called my critique partner, who's also a teacher, and she's out in Utah, so she was on a different time and she was still in school. And I was out of people who cared. I was just sitting there by myself at the dining room table, and somebody needs to scoop the litter pan. That needs to get done. So I get up and I go scoop the litter pan. You know, your day-to-day life doesn't change that much. You said if you're a full-time author, maybe it's different. It's really not. I love being a full-time writer. There's definite concerns. Health insurance, you never know if you're going to sell another book. You only get paid twice a year. I do like it. I hope I can continue to be this way. But there's nothing glorious or glamorous about it. I can't tell you the last time I put on makeup. I mean, there's no reason to.
I'm sure lifestyles plays into it too. Like, I'm a homebody. I love being at home. I go out just because I love the feeling of coming home. It's romanticized in my mind. You wake up in the morning, you have your cup of tea, and you sit down in front of the blank page, and oh, it was torturous. Like, that I know is in my mind. And I know that whatever I think sounds like a great lifestyle, the second I'm doing it, it doesn't feel like the romanticized version in my head. That's why I don't spend a lot of time dreaming about this kind of thing, because it is what it is. I have a great life. I'm happy. I'm a full-time pediatric nurse. Plus, I have a book published. So it's amazing. Day-to-day life doesn't change all that much, except there's like all these really exciting things that happen, which probably is really good mentally for me, because release of endorphins multiple times a day. Mm-hmm. When I think about all the exciting things, or there's a trip coming up, I'm going to this conference. Those are like little boosts, right? That does a lot for my mental health and just for my general well-being. This whole you're an author thing, what is that? There's multiple copies of my book, and my nephew's 7, and he walks by and he's like, I don't know why you have so many of this book. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm an author. And he's like, I don't care.
I was in Boston with my sister and her kids, and we were walking down the street, and my nephew, who would have been about 7 or 8 at the time, is a real reader. Like, he just thought that was so amazing that I was published. And we're walking down the street in Boston, and he's like, Aunt Mindy, why aren't people looking at you?
That's cute.
I was like, what do you mean, Rye? And he's like, no one is stopping and going, oh my God, that's Mindy McGinnis. And I just started laughing. And I'm like, Ryan, no one is ever going to stop and say, oh my God, that's Mindy McGinnis. It just doesn't work that way when you're a writer. Whenever I see any kind of advert for a writer's conference or anything about being published or being a writer, it's always either showing a attractive young woman sitting in a hammock with tea or coffee or some warm drink with steam coming up from it. And she usually is in a reclining position and pen like resting against her face, or a very serious looking man in a coffee shop with like 5 o'clock stubble. And, you know, everyone is beautifully tortured as they try to write.
Yeah.
When I write, I'm in my pajamas and I'm laying in bed and I have sometimes dirty hair, because why take a shower when no one sees you? It's not romantic. There's nothing beautiful about it.
I have this idea of what life would feel like if I lived here, if I had this, if I looked like this, if I was doing this. And in my mind, it just sounds so wonderful. I'll even think, if I lived in the house next door, I think I would want to get up and clean that house more. So even though getting your first book published is the most amazing thing ever, and it's a very private thing because nobody's as excited as you are, and your partner, whoever's with you and has seen you through the journey, but for the most part, it's just all this excitement that's happening internally. It is incredibly amazing, and it's such an accomplishment. And then to suddenly be able to grab this identity of, I am an author now, it's exactly what you hope it will feel like, but then you quickly realize that it's very internal. Everything
Next up, we unpack a few key scenes in Girl Man's Up, address the complexities of introducing a language barrier to the generation gap, and talk about keeping it honest with the not so happily ever after endings.
Previously to this, I had worked in a high school library for 15 years. And I have seen many great books for queer and transgender teens come across the circ desk. I do all the processing, and so I'm always going through all the books and taking a look at them and making some kind of judgment call as far as what is appropriate age-wise. The library that I worked in served everyone from fifth graders to seniors, so obviously we had an array of books there. As a straight person, what really resonated for me in
Making Out with a Boy,
there's a scene where Pen, your main character, and she thinks, this is gay. I feel gay right now. And it cut right to the core of sexual preference, not as a choice, but as an identity, and made me, as a straight person, understand a different lifestyle in a way that I hadn't before, though I'd always empathized. So can you talk a little bit about that scene in particular and what went into writing it for you? And I'm also curious, just from a writer's point of view, have you had other people, queer or straight, comment to you about that scene in particular? Because I know it was really powerful to me, so I'm just curious if it resonated for others in that way.
Yes, I can totally talk about that. And funnily enough, there has recently been a comment about that exact thing in the novel. I mean, if we were doing this like a week and a half ago, it would have been like, no, nobody's talked about this, but now let's talk about it. The reason I wanted to put that in there, first of all, is because it's always been a feeling with me and my girlfriend. We would discuss that. We would think about what we think other people felt was queer or was gay. There'll be two guys, you know, walking too close. Oh, that's gay. Or I accidentally touched your butt like in high school. That's gay. Like that kind of thing, right? For us being two queer people, certain things made us feel the feeling that's behind the word gay, the expression gay or queer, that were actually not queer. For example, I made my girlfriend, who is very much like Penn in the way she looks and acts, I made her put on some of my clothes. Mm-hmm. Like, you should dress up as me for Halloween. And then she put it on and she was like, oh my God, that's so gay. And I was like, it's so gay. It's you in women's clothes, even though you're a woman. So it's very not queer that you, woman, should be able to wear these clothes according to society. I wanted to put that in the book because I think a lot of us, and this is not just myself and my girlfriend, a lot of us queer folk have had this experience of, well, for cis and straight people, the idea of what's queer, our idea of what can be queer in that sense is not according to society. I was hoping that it was going to hit some readers I thought would just think, okay, I'm not even going to pay attention to that because it doesn't really make sense. And some readers I was hoping would be like, oh, so for her, that feels queer. That feels odd. But then again, there's been some reaction, kind of like they took it the opposite way of what I meant it, which I knew was going to be a possibility. So that's okay. There's things I put in there that I knew were going to be appreciated by some and not appreciated at all by others. For me, it was an incredibly important thing to put in there because to Penn, in her internal dialogue, that was queer. Not everything that she's been doing that has been her, that everyone else feels is queer, that was queer. Other people would have been like, that's not queer. That's fine. You're allowed to do that. This other stuff you're doing, that's queer. And she's like, no, that's me. This stuff's queer. So that's why I wanted to put that in there, to kind of get those readers to think, oh, that's how it feels.
And that's exactly how it worked for me. I was like, God, that's awesome. And I love that it's in a book for teens. So it's like maybe someone who is straight can have that moment when they're younger and have a better appreciation of the other perspectives. I just thought it was really powerful.
Thank you. No, I'm glad it came off that way. A lot of us are queer, but we are also not knowledgeable, or we haven't had much experience with all of the queer people of the world and all of the ways that people can be different. And I think that that moment of, oh, I see now why this feels regular to some people. I think that letting Penn put her feelings out there is hopefully going to be the best way to get some people to be like, okay, I see now. Because that's the best way to understand people's perspectives, is just to really be immersed in how they're living their lives and how they feel and think.
One of the other things that I want to talk about with Girl Man's Up that I thought was just awesome. As a writer and as a reader, I appreciated it so much. You made the choice to have Penn be from a Portuguese family, and for her parents to not have a full grasp of English, and for Penn to not have a great handle on Portuguese. Mm-hmm. So there are times when true communication barrier exists between the generations in more ways than one. In some scenes, they literally cannot understand what each other are saying, but at the same time, there's a resistance on the parents' part toward understanding who Penn is as a person. And so I believe there's a scene where Penn says, she's just standing there with her mother in front of her, and she says, I don't understand you. And it's just so true on so many levels. And you know the mother is feeling the same way. And there's just this true communication barrier and empathy barrier between them that is both language and worldview. So was this a conscious choice that you made while crafting the book?
It was absolutely a conscious choice. Penn ended up being Portuguese because, heavily inspired by my girlfriend, Melissa, who is Portuguese. Mm-hmm. Just watching a lot of the interactions in the community, the Portuguese communities and the families, watching the way that she, the kind of Portuguese language that she has, which is very functional, and she can completely be out there and do her Portuguese thing. But when concepts and feelings and emotions and more complicated things that require different vocabularies needed, then she quickly has to use the English. Myself being French, my first language is French. I went to French school right up until college, and you know, we are damn French. But my language is so much more developed in English, and that's just because of purely where I live. Now, my nephew, who still has a French accent when he speaks English because he spent the first few years in Quebec, he's 7 now, is actually being told that he's not using his French enough at school, that he's doing too much English, because all the shows we watched, all the video games, his friends, all of that stuff is in English. So for Penn, it's the same thing. All of her friends, all of her TV shows, all of her games, everything was in English. Her brother the primary person that she had to dialogue with as a kid and who exposed her to many things like music and all that, you know, all that stuff was primarily in English. So that's why Penn has enough Portuguese to say, I don't feel good. Yeah, I did my homework. Yeah, I want to eat this. She can't actually talk about anything but the surface stuff. And then you've got the parents who, they wanted that for her. They wanted her to be able to get around and do her thing because they have trouble. You know, when it's time to go get their health card renewed and stuff like that, they got to bring brother with them. That's created this thing where your kid is exactly where you wanted your kid to be. So you can be in Canada and she's good to go in English. But now what? Now how do you talk about these more difficult things? And to this day, I mean, I'm perfectly bilingual. People can't really tell when I speak French that I speak better English, but I don't have a lot of the vocabulary that I would need to get into this kind of conversation that we're getting into right now. I would have to stop and say I couldn't carry on, and can I switch to English? In this book, how difficult is it when all your parents know about you is what they're seeing right now and what they're observing, and you're not able to explain yourself in a way that's meaningful, and then your parents also can't. They haven't really explained who they are as human beings because everything was pretty much work and eating and going to school, doing your homework and doing your chores. And how difficult would it be for any kid in that position, but a kid like Penn? She's never going to get through to them. She doesn't have the words.
Yeah. One of the things that I enjoyed about it so much was that you didn't make it okay. Everything's happy in the end. Everybody has accepted everyone and things are great. Because that doesn't always happen. That doesn't always happen in real life. And I really dislike nicely tied up, happily ever after endings, because that is not real life. Real life does not work that way.
I know.
And I liked that you did not have everything come together perfectly and everyone understand and accept at the end, which hopefully not too much of a spoiler, but you kept it real.
There's time, right? In the time frame of the novel, just wasn't realistic to me. There's a lot of toxic relationships just all around in Penn's life. And some of these things, yeah, they got tied up at the end of the novel, just not in the way that we might want things to get tied up in a novel for a younger audience. This is new to me, getting reader mail, right? Getting emails and messages from readers. And I can't tell you how many teens are writing to me and talking about toxic relationships in their lives and how I have a brother and he left because of it. And I wish that I could tell my friend to go to hell and all that. So they're experiencing these toxic relationships. And you know what? I think all of us are aware, even at that age, some of these things don't need to get tied up neatly, because at the end of the day, if you're still not able to be who you are and you're still not in a good relationship with whoever we're talking about, you may need to just put up a wall and distance yourself from certain things. That was something really important to me. I wanted to put that in there.
Ending out with the simultaneous publishing of Girl Man's Up in both Canada and the U.S., as well as the potential deal breaker of M.E. changing her setting and where to find the author online.
You mentioned, and I want to bring it back up because I think it's an interesting point, that you're from Canada. Girl Man's Up is set in Canada. And when you were going to get published, you had to think about that as an element in your journey, because you needed to be published by an American and Canadian publisher. And as well, when it comes to your readers, you chose to set the book in Canada. So did you have any concerns about U.S. teens having a hard time relating to the setting?
I asked myself, what are my deal breakers related to story, related to setting, related just to everything? And my biggest deal breaker was the fact that it was set in Canada. If somebody had said, oh, can you set it in the U.S. because it'll be more appealing to readers, but whatever the reason, that was a great big fat no to me. And I had clear reasons for that. I'm Canadian. I'm very proud of where I live, part of my identity. But also in Canada here, we're kind of oversaturated by American media, I guess. So a lot of our TV shows, music, even cultural things that don't really happen in Canada, we are well versed in because of the books, the TV shows, the movies, all of that. I keep saying there's things like pep rallies and words like freshman, and we don't use that here. I felt like you people in the United States, your readers are probably smart enough and able to also do the same thing when it comes to our Canadian media. So of course, like, nobody's had an issue at all. I really wanted to throw a bit of Canada over to you guys But I also knew that publishing in Canada is different for many reasons that I can't really dive into right now because I'm not that well versed in it. But basically, our publishing industry is different out here than it is where you are. Although I wanted to be published in Canada, that was incredibly important to me, I wanted to have a bigger reach. So a lot of books that are published in the US will make it out here, but books that are published here don't always make it out to you guys. That's why I asked myself right in the beginning, okay, where am I going with this? Where do I want to go? So I queried right to New York, looking for American agents, looking for American publisher, and then was kind of waiting and seeing what was going to happen. And I got lucky that HarperCollins Canada ended up in on the deal with HarperTeen. I ended up getting the dual publishing. So I got incredibly lucky that way. I wanted my story to compete and to be sitting up there with all the other amazing queer YA stories that are coming out. There's a lot of them in the US. There's many of them in Canada, but there's a lot of them in the US. I wanted it all, man.
Well, you wanted the broadest audience possible for your book. Yeah, and that only makes sense.
God, what if they come back and say, we love everything, we'll give you this 14-figure deal. What is that? I don't even know. If you'll just make it American. And I was like, oh, it's important to me. It's a choice of the storyteller. This is where the story takes place. So I feel like I created this world in my mind because all my stories take place in the same area. I can't make the move to a different country.
When you're a debut author, you don't have a lot in your corners. So you worry about what is there in my book that I am not willing to change or to part with.
Yep.
And for me, with my first book, ending is not particularly happy if you are someone that reads for romance. And I made a conscious choice to not give them a happily ever after in a pretty dramatic way. I've had readers just get so upset with me, like be angry with me. I think it's so cool because, you know, we're talking about the title of this podcast is Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire. And that's what I call my blog as well that I started a long time ago. Because essentially, we're liars. We are trying to make people care about things that never happened to people that don't exist.
Oh,
so
nice.
if you are so upset about something that I made you believe happened to a real person, I don't care if you're pissed at me. You care. Like, you care so much that you are mad and you're going to shoot me an angry email. That is a huge compliment.
Ha, okay. Yeah, no, I think that's true. Yeah, if they feel like, how dare you do this to these people? Totally. I mean, also, there's this fine line, too, between are they pissed off because they think I screwed up. A lot of people, I've had that particular feeling almost with Colby, Penn's best friend in the book, and how some people hate his guts so much. Some people think it may have gone too far. It's unrealistically evil. And I've gone back and read some exchanges and been like, no, I'm satisfied with the way I did it. I'll take their anger as a good. You should be angry.
It's a compliment.
Yes.
And I think when it comes to Colby's character, I think you did a good job of, you're illustrating a male who's behaving the way he believes an alpha male is supposed to behave.
Yes.
But I think he does have, it's small, but it's there. There are glimpses of a softer version of him.
Of course. I mean, they're friends for a reason.
I interpreted that he did have real feelings for Olivia and was scared of them because he's not supposed to have feelings because he's a man. I really felt that he was a very realistic portrayal of the teenage boy who is trying to be the alpha male that he's supposed to be.
Oh, of course. And Colby in private is not Colby socially out in the world.
And I found him to be sympathetic in that way, because it's a very real struggle for men too. I mean, we talk a lot about social pressures on women, and by God, they're there and they exist for men too. And sometimes they don't get enough attention. But I think you did an excellent job touching on that as well. I'm going to ask you before we go to give any of your social media follows or anything that where people can find you online if they'd like to come find you.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to make it simple. My website is emmygerard.com and I have these cute little icons at the top.
Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow author Alyssa Palumbo and patrons Stephen Avery and Emily Suyot for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire.